I'm thrilled to see so many of you up and around this morning, and I hope you had a good time last night. I listed a web page here, which is a project web page, in case you're if you want to follow up on some of the things that I have to say. You'll find some reports here and some mapping and other things as background. And I don't think you're going to see a picture like this now, but this was taken 4 months after Katrina. And I guess there probably are some houses in that condition, although the refrigerator is probably not still up on the roof by now. It'd be pretty stinky. But in fact, this was taken in the Lower Ninth Ward, and most of those blocks of housing have been demolished. And the question about, what kinds of questions does a sociologist have looking at a picture like that? And I have to say my principal questions are questions like, who lived in this house, and where are they now, and what are the odds that this neighborhood will recover? And if not this neighborhood, what neighborhood will recover? I'll give just a little bit of theoretical context. I'm not going to be talking theory today, and I'm really not going to talk method. I'm just going to tell you some things that we've seen over the last 2 years in terms of the recovery of New Orleans after Katrina. And I want to mention the approach that, as I understand it, from an ecological perspective, about resilience. One idea is, in fact, that systems are resilient. And in the social science literature, this has been picked up, the people who study disasters as a profession, you know, there's a specialization in the social sciences of that, have picked up on this concept of resilience, thinking of social systems very much in the same way that others think about ecological systems, as whole systems. And the question is, looking at the system as a whole, how long does it take for it to recover? There's a shock, but the assumption is that there is a recovery in most cases. And social scientists have added to that, I think, the notion that, in fact, a disaster can be a stimulus. People sometimes use the term creative destruction to refer to the opportunities that are presented after a disaster. And one of the opportunities is the opportunity to bring in financial assistance from outside of the region. This shows up in terms of government payments of all kinds, insurance payments. And one of the familiar assumptions about most disasters in the social science literature is not only that there is a recovery, but that there may even be a stimulus as a result of the disaster. It turns out, of course, not to seem to be the case, at least. I don't think it's the case with Katrina, although it might be in some places. If we look very closely, we might see that there have been benefits in some sectors. And the other concept is the one of adaptive recovery, and in fact, Steve Hamburg's talk after me, I think, is going to build on that kind of an idea, that systems evolve in such a way that they can adapt to the anticipation of a disaster and be not very much affected by it. Social scientists have wondered whether, in fact, social systems are capable of doing that. Do we stop building on the coast when we discover that it's risky? I think you know the answer to that. But there are other ways to adapt to the anticipation of risk or the existence of risk, such as insurance systems. Systems of insurance are, from a social perspective, a vehicle for anticipating disaster and figuring out how to minimize the cost of the disaster when it strikes. So these concepts have been picked up in the social science literature, and what I want to emphasize about them is that they are applied to the system as a whole. It's like the whole social system, we're all in it together. Is the question, is the system capable of adapting? Is there enough power? Is there enough capacity, organizational capacity, political capability, economic strength for the system as a whole to be resilient? We've tended to go beyond that point of view to looking at societies not as a single entity, although you can usefully look at societies as whole systems, but break it down into its components, the pieces, the places, the particular kinds of people, and how are they affected by disaster? And that's the most interesting question from my perspective. So we talk about social vulnerability and resilience. And the term vulnerability here is suggesting that really built into it is the notion that some people are more at risk than others. The concept of locational vulnerability is that some people are more at risk because of where they're located. You know, if you're located right on the earthquake fault, that's a locational vulnerability. And we ask, and who is placed in those positions? Turns out that in New Orleans, vulnerability was very much a matter of elevation. And we ask, well, who was in the low-lying areas? And it's quite clear what the historical development pattern was for the city. There's good reasons why certain groups with less resources were placed in the least valuable land, which was the low-lying land that always floods. And I don't know, we haven't seen it this week. But during the summer, I read that there was a rainfall here, and many parts of the city were under a foot of water. Well, because that's just normal. Katrina brought 10 feet or 20 feet to the same place. Anyway, locational vulnerability, who is in those locations and why? And then the idea of segmented resilience. Segmented suggesting that there are some segments or sectors that are more resilient than others. And we ask, who will recover, and what are the predictors of that? And of course, you wouldn't be surprised that we'd figure that there are some population groups that have more resources, especially more economic resources, sometimes more political resources, sometimes just plain more personal resources. Like young people have the strength and the energy to deal with the insurance companies and rebuilding the house and all of that stuff. And on the whole, people, I'm 60, so I'm, by some reckonings, I'm now a senior citizen, but at about 75 or 80, people really find it tough to be personally resilient, even if they had the money and they got the insurance payment. So the question of segmented resilience is raising the issue of, well, who in the society, what groups, not just where they are, but who they are, will be resilient. That's the basic idea, and then I've got another 10 minutes or so. I'm going to just illustrate that from the point of view of things we know about this particular catastrophe. This is a map that shows the city of New Orleans. There's this line here actually demarcates the western edge of the city, and to the left is Jefferson Parish. But the rest of this is pretty much all the city. And there's an area called Algiers here on the other side of the river, which is also part of New Orleans. And it shows two things that are important to see how they relate to each other. One is, what are the areas that flooded? And flooded, as you know, means not just there was a little bit of water, but there was 5 feet or 10 feet or 20 feet, and it was there for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So really, pretty much, those cross-hatched areas were pretty battered. And it also shows the racial composition of the census tracts within and around the city. The purple demarcates, that really bright purple, is areas that are 75% black or more. New Orleans is unusual as an American city by how large a proportion of the population is black and how few other minority groups lived in the city. It was pretty much a black and white city. But in terms of its level of segregation, this is just like any other American metropolitan area, pretty much. A highly segregated city. And you can see lots of areas, New Orleans East, the lower Ninth Ward and Holy Cross, and some areas closer to downtown, Gentilly here, pretty much black neighborhoods. It's 75%, actually more like 90 or 95% black. And then some more like you'd call them enclaves, I think. The Lakeview here, sort of a suburban type of housing development. 90-95% white, very upper middle class neighborhoods. And here's we're somewhere in here, I'm sure. My hotel is right around there. The French Quarter and the area where Tulane University is higher ground, and it turns out also to be a whiter area. Overall, you can probably notice that the pattern is that every predominantly black neighborhood of the city was flooded, and Lakeview is the only predominantly white area of the city that was flooded. It, you might say equal opportunity flooding, but it turns out not to be quite equal opportunity. Black neighborhoods were hit harder because they were lower elevation. And this responds to the notion of locational vulnerability. Who was vulnerable because of where they lived? This area here of New Orleans East, which is very black, is also very middle class on the whole. This area, which is black, is very working class, I would say, in its origins. And there's a lot of public housing in here, too. So it's different social classes, but turns out to be predominantly the black areas that were hit. And also, it turns out to be African Americans who could not get back. This is an assessment from the same time I took that picture I showed you, December of 2005, 4 months after the hurricane. And it's an estimate. I wouldn't put too much faith in these numbers. I probably should have rounded them off because who knows what the exact numbers are. But the differences between whites and blacks in this respect are quite startling. The total number of whites who were displaced by this figure, who had to leave home because of the coming of the hurricane or after the hurricane, was much larger than the number of blacks, 400,000 versus 200,000. But on the other hand, a large majority of whites in the New Orleans metro area had already returned home by December. An almost majority of African Americans were not only living away from the metropolitan area, but they were in another state, displaced to another state. And this continues to be generally the pattern. So this refers to this takes us to the notion of segmented resilience. Who can come right back? Who's left hanging? And then there is the question of another question related to segmented resilience, which is whose neighborhoods will be rebuilt? This was the first plan that was brought up by the Bring Back New Orleans Commission, the Bring New Orleans Back Commission. Mayor Nagin appointed these guys, said, tell me what you think we ought to do. And when they reported this is what we should do, he said, oh, no, I could never tell people that. Because this map shows that some areas of the city would be reinvested quickly and others would be put on hold. The immediate opportunity areas, undamaged area here on the other side of the river, undamaged areas around the high ground on the other side of the river, and the idea was these areas we should do something. The rest of the city are called neighborhood planning areas, and I want you to know, in case anybody ever suggests it to you, you do not want to have your house in a neighborhood planning area, a wait and see area, because it means you're going to be left behind. And the criterion for deciding which of these neighborhood planning areas would eventually be redeveloped was going to be who began to return, who showed by voting with their feet that they were going to come back, they were going to take seriously the problem of rebuilding, they were going to demand help from the city, and that would be the criterion. It's kind of a market criterion. Let the market decide which areas should come back. And as a sociologist, I have no trouble predicting for you what kinds of neighborhoods would be resilient in that respect. It would not be the public housing neighborhoods, because you couldn't come back to those. They were shut tight. People were expelled and can't come back. So that wouldn't be those neighborhoods. The most likely would be Lakeview here. The predominantly white, predominantly homeowning, predominantly upper middle class part of the city. Lakeview people have over the years emphasized the importance of their neighborhood, that although it has only a fraction of the population of the city, it's something like 40% of the residential tax base. So, you know, Lakeview counts. And I would have predicted, I think the Bring New Orleans Back Commission would also have predicted, that when they put Lakeview in the wait and see zone, that what they were going to see is that Lakeview would be the one that would demand to be taken care of. Well, this was the first plan. This is the voter turnout a few months later in the mayoral election. This is the primary, but it's pretty much the same as the second round. And areas in dark brown voted at or actually above the percent of registered voters turning out as had voted in the previous mayoral election in 2002. So you see some areas of the city really did participate in the election. Some areas, 30-40%. And it's very much related to the damage. Flooded areas where people were gone. This was widely predicted. There's a lot of litigation about this question. Should people have more opportunities if they're displaced in Houston or Atlanta or somewhere to go there somewhere and vote? Lakeview is the one area of the city that voted at close to its prior level, despite the fact that nobody was living there. So segmented resilience showing up here in terms of people. Well, this is not voting with their feet. This is voting with their absentee ballot, mostly, or coming in sometime and casting the vote in person. Another measure of this segmented resilience is shown a few months later by what public schools were reopened in the city. What's the pattern? What's the pattern of reopening? New Orleans East, there's a couple of schools. There used to be 15 or so. Gentilly, Lakeview actually didn't have any schools open. The reopenings were all very highly concentrated in the areas that were the undamaged areas, showing, I would say, a decision by public authorities faced with limited resources to concentrate resources exactly in the way contemplated by that Bring New Orleans Back Commission plan that was renounced by the mayor as saying, oh no, we can't do that, we got to all come back. But the actual investments are clearly by August of 2006 in the areas that were less damaged. So that's clearly the plan. And finally, in last spring, under the new development czar, Ed Blakely, there was the proud announcement of the plan for 17 targeted recovery zones that will spur redevelopment and accelerate our recovery. And areas were put into three categories. The rebuild zones, these are areas that were pretty much messed up, and if the city was going to do something, it would take a lot of public investment. And on the other hand, there's at the other end is renew zones, which are areas where the calculation was that public investments would have a higher return because they would leverage private investment more. And let's see where they were. If we can see where they are, there we are. So the rebuild zones, these are the heavily damaged areas that would take a lot of public investment. One was identified in Holy Cross and another in New Orleans East. Areas where it was thought we really should be putting the money because it will yield private investment too. Highly concentrated, same areas where we saw the schools were reopened. Highly concentrated, except for one up here, which is a section that also was not flooded near University of New Orleans. And Lakeview is put not in the rebuild category, rebuild meaning if we do it, we're going to have to be prepared to spend a lot of public money, but it was put in the category of probably a high priority area because it'll take some doing, but if we do it, this is an area that will come back. So we see the same logic here in terms of all of these plans over time and choices about the use of public funds and public policy to promote what I would call a pattern of segmented resilience that very much matches the pattern we saw of locational vulnerability, but it is the least vulnerable places that will show the resilience because that's the direction that policy is working. Now, I'd just like to emphasize that this is the way we probably normally do things in America. New Orleans is not, I don't think, particularly retrograde in this respect. We favor letting the market make the decisions. We don't really want to put a lot of public investment in areas that were populated by people living in public housing. We're not very interested in redeveloping the rental housing market in the city. I think it's very American to say that if we're providing those people rental assistance in Houston, let them stay in Houston, because the people we talk to who've come back here, they talk about how they're worried about the rental housing in their neighborhood. Could our neighborhood become a rental neighborhood, and wouldn't that be a shame? Or are they going to build cheap modular housing in our neighborhood, and wouldn't that be a shame? So this is the direction of recovery, and it illustrates the concepts that I started with, the typical social science approach of locational vulnerability and segmented resilience. I'm not sure to what extent those would apply if we were looking at forests or coastlines or physical systems, but this is the heart of the issues that a social scientist would want to ask. Thank you.